Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Trend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Terence Corrigan. Let's get into the news of today. And ANC Women's League, or ANC veteran, Naledi Pandor, was giving a speech recently at a tribute to a former president of the ANC Women's League. And Naledi Pandor made some quite sharp comments about the direction that the ANC was heading in. She said, "We've lost our glory. Let's not pretend about it. Pretend about it. The people are looking at us with disdain, with horror, and shame." She said she knew of the corruption. Speaking of the deceased, she knew of the corruption that had dragged the revolutionary morality of our leader down. She was aware of the failures at local government and of the inadequate capacity to serve, which is prevalent in our public service. She knew well about the decline of her beloved African National Congress, not just in election results, but in the ability to stay true to its role as a leader of society and the values of serving the people. Now, one wonders whether she will also receive some sort of disciplinary action from the Thuli House, as other senior ANC members have also gotten recently for making similar comments. But regardless, and we've gotten more details from that DA polling, which I think we talked about last week. In fact, that Terence and I talked about last week, which showed the ANC support in Joburg collapsing. While City Press has gotten more details about it, and over the weekend they reported exactly those details. National turnout. Is quite interesting, and I'll explain why later. The ANC is, according to this poll, at 29% nationally to the DA's 28, and I think MK, I think, was in third place on 11. What's more interesting is if you look at the polling done in the various metros, this DA poll said that the DA is on 48%, 16% increase from last time in Tshwane. The ANC at 27. In Ekurhuleni, the East Rand, and in Gauteng, the DA is at 41, up 13 points. The ANC is down at 19, which is down by 19. The EFF at 12 and the MK party at 11. In eThekwini, Durban, this is, I think, perhaps the most shocking poll result. The DA is at 44, up 18 points. MK party is at 31. And the ANC in a distant third place at 14%, with the IFP at 8%. In Cape Town, this DA poll said that they're on 61%, the ANC is on 19%, and the Patriotic Alliance on 9%, almost doubling their vote share, but still being quite far behind everyone else. So, Terence, these two stories kind of go quite well together. Naledi Pandor criticizing her own party, declaring that the people look at the ANC with horror and shame. And the polling that we have, all the caveats that it is from the DA, and while it's probably accurate, you know, the ANC tends to get better results come election time. So, you know, these polls are usually just a snapshot rather than a sort of prediction. That being said, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I think the thing that jumps out at me about about Dr. Pandor's speech is how trapped in the past it was. That talking about the collapse of the present of the ANC in the present, the entire frame of reference was what had gone before. I think there's two problems with that. First of all, the past is the past. A political party that does not adapt to changing circumstances is rapidly running out of road. This goes for any party and any polity. And I think that there were glimpses of the ANC being able to do this at one stage, but I think that, you know, certainly since the Mbeki era, it's just kind of flatlined, unable to adapt to a new world, to a new type of society, to people who do not, in the main, have direct memories of apartheid, or don't see that as the kind of focus of their life. There is very little in the ANC that shows that it is able to sort of shake the idea that its great historical mission defeating the apartheid regime or its great historical achievement is something that it can no longer rely on. It's interesting that Gertrude Shopee, I think it's it would have been 100 years old or died at 100. All credit to her. She lived a remarkable life, but she belonged to a previous generation. Unfortunately, many of those, much of the collapse, I would say, owes to the fact that it simply couldn't shake that tradition. Here's the most obvious thing. You talked about this with me before. When P.W. Botha reached the end of his reformist repertoire, as imperfect as it may have been, there was an F.W. de Klerk to step in. I just don't see who can do this in the ANC. What seems to be on offer is always more of the same. There was a great deal of excitement when President Mandela departed, and President Mbeki was going to be the man to take the party forward. That didn't work out so well. Well, Jacob Zuma will take the ANC once again back to its roots. Well, that didn't work out so well. So we get a new dawn under President Ramaphosa. There was a lot of excitement about that, and once again, unable to sort of show any direction. And really, what's the most inspirational choice? Replay of Zuma with Paul Mashatile, or Patrice Motsepe, who isn't even really a politician. That seems to be the height of the offering.
Now you're counting out Fikile and Balula so early.
Well, no, okay, but for Gideon Mbalula, all right, fine. No, look, the point is there's a dreadful familiarity with what is on offer. There's no new generation stepping in. Maybe that's just as well, because what seems to come out of these new out of the new generations is more frighteningly scary than what was in the old, which is a concern. Young people in Vietnam don't obsess about the American war in the 1960s. They say things like joint venture. You can see the complete victory of politics over administration in the state of our cities. In cities, you need a government. Perhaps if you're living out in the sticks, and you've never had anyone to rely on, you learn to make a plan. You can't do that when millions of people are bound together. And I'll say this with all due respect and reverence for the libertarians who watch us. For a city, you need some sort of esprit de corps, some sort of administrative capacity. Well, the state of Johannesburg speaks very, very strongly in the other direction. And I think for many people for whom the DA is, let's say, an unpalatable choice, they're looking at it and saying, well, Cape Town has a functioning city centre, which Johannesburg doesn't. That was the thing that jumped out at me when I was there a couple of weeks ago. That you can go into the centre of Cape Town, there's restaurants, and you can walk around, and it survives. I double dog dare you to do that in Joburg at night.
Joburg CBD is not for the faint of heart. I just want to talk a little bit about more about the specifics of some of this polling. Firstly, the reporting here done by Report and City Press says that the DA modeled their turnout here on 100% voter turnout. If the DA is on 28% with 100% voter turnout, that's actually an incredible result for them. The DA tends to have voters who are slightly more motivated. You find that the MK party tends to have some of the least motivated voters. If they show up, they'll vote for MK, but they're difficult to turn out. And in fact, one of the reasons that they did quite well in the last election was because they managed to turn those people out on election day, even though some of them were a bit sort of on the fence, it seems, about voting. The DA usually benefits actually from kind of lower turnout because its voters are more likely to turn out, which means that the least enthusiastic voters vote for other parties and they sort of fall away. So at 28% for the DA here is a really good number, because it suggests that in an actual election where the turnout might be close to 50%, the DA will actually do even better than that. Now, that being said, there's the big caveat that the DA has polled at 30% or close to 30% before, and then not gotten it on election day. If you go and you look at the Social Research Foundation's polling about 6 weeks before the election in 2024, you'll see that the DA was on about 28%, kind of where it is now, and that decreased till they got, you know, just around 22% or whatever it was on the day at come the election time. And that was the ANC's election campaign managing to squeeze the DA back in. But let's just put it this way. Things are getting worse in terms of the sort of top line numbers for the ANC. And there's always been, if you go and look back at the data over the years, there's always been this significant chunk of ANC voters and Black South Africans who've said either they're open to voting for the DA, or after the ANC, the DA is their second choice. And in every election, the DA has kind of said, these people are going to come to us, these people are going to come to us, and then they haven't, or at least not in significant numbers, just a little bit. What we might be seeing in this polling here, if it indeed is the case, is that group of people finally breaking away from the ANC and going, okay, let's give option two a shot, because option one is clearly not working out. It's also worth pointing out that historically the ANC does much worse in municipal elections. So that's another reason to think these numbers might not be completely bonkers. In fact, that MK party number at 31% in Durban is not that shocking when you consider that it is a municipal election and MK voters so far have not proven to be, you know, the most enthusiastic to go out and vote. So that's significantly down. I think they got like 48% or something in Durban in the last national election. So them down at 31 could just be a fact that the party just isn't able to turn out those people. But who knows? You know, it gets a bit complicated when you have to start factoring in turnout and stuff like that, which this doesn't. Anyway, point being, Terence, do you have any thoughts on all of that? Do you think I'm right? Or do I think the DA is going to get 44% in Durban in the next local government election? Probably not. I think it might be high 30s if they have a very good election. Do you think my skepticism is warranted, or do you think that we're seeing even more of a Titanic shift than I'm giving credit for?
First of all, we're not in campaigning mode, and that can have a big impact on the way that people sentiment plays out. My sense of it is that the ANC is traditionally disappointed between elections, but as elections arise, they create a vibe. They were very good at this. The cavalcades through their voting strongholds get people excited. Those who might have been considering defecting feel that, you know, the community is excited. They don't want to be left out, so they jump on the train, and we give the ANC another chance. Still a lot of resonance. So I think there will be elements of this. I think, though, that the ANC is probably facing facing a sea change. Things like the unrelenting stream of scandals, just the general collapse of urban governance, the stratospheric unemployment, all of these things, and promises. And I think the national dialogue may well end up working against it. Because what they've done is they've provided a platform for people to spend the next year or so complaining about all the dreadful things that the ANC has presided over, which is not which is not smart. And I think that there is also perhaps some truth to the idea that the DA has been in the government. That's something that you know, the idea of a coalition and getting people to work together for the good of the people has been a very popular one, including with ANC supporters. And yes, you know, the DA is in the government. They haven't brought back apartheid. you know, what you get is Leon Schreiber going to Home Affairs and staff that's almost entirely black, you know, toying and ululating and whatever. And I think that creates certain bridges. So yes, I think that there is a part of their constituency that might say, well, we've got a democracy, let's use it.
All right. Let's talk about our next story here. And this is some reporting which suggests that from the Sunday Times, which suggests that South Africa's police are shockingly under-resourced. Now, this is not news, I think, to any of us who've interacted with the cops, but this is truly the sort of scope of the problem is quite something to see in this reporting. They asked policemen from different units, from different provinces across the country, in the Sunday Times, what exactly the problems with equipment were. The police budget is just over 120 billion rand in the financial year of 2025-2026. Apparently 80% of that is allocated for salaries. And once you get through the filter of corrupt processes and misspending and all that sort of stuff, what you get on the ground are some of these horror stories. And I'll read from the story here. This is from an anti-gang unit member in the Western Cape. "We've been made promises about resources, but they were all empty. We have about 5 working vehicles on the road. That is for 30 members who must share them. We don't have enough pistols. There's a good chance you'll be involved in a shooting. If that happens, you must hand in your firearm. But while that pistol is with ballistics, there are no temporary weapons available, so you're effectively unarmed. And this is in one of the most dangerous units in SAPS. I know of at least 5 members who don't have bulletproof jackets. Imagine you're an anti-gang unit officer and you don't have a pistol or a bulletproof. We have asked many times for replacements, but management say they just don't have stock. In the Eastern Cape, a search and rescue police unit says, officer says, the police need to get someone to build canopies and kennels for the dogs on the vehicles. This took 7 months. SAPS kept denying the request. As soon as you ask for something expensive, you know it will be denied. Most of the stuff on our vehicles is sponsored by local businesses. These boats have been patched and patched again. There are almost more patches than boat, but there are no chances of new ones. This officer said that car tires are a problem. They've seen their colleagues stealing tires from broken down and boarded vehicles because police management were not coming through with new tires. This is just so that they can work in Limpopo. The police there say that they sometimes have to use unmarked buckies. One officer said, we can't afford to catch Limpopo crooks in other provinces. Our travel budget will be depleted early in the financial year. We get told we have less than last year. This happens every year. On top of that, we are spending hundreds of rands of our own money every month to make official calls. A detective with a stock theft unit in Limpopo said, how can you work without vehicles? Our district incorporates more than 30 police stations. Some are more than 300 kilometers away. We have one vehicle in working condition. Police Union Pop Crew spokesperson says that the equipment shortages are not confined to a few isolated units. It cuts across almost every sphere of policing, from specialized anti-crime task teams to rural and border policing units. Terence, is it any wonder that morale is low in the cops?
No, absolutely not. And I've been hearing this for well over a decade. And this is from actual police officers. Old order, new order, it doesn't matter. Things about bulletproof vests, for instance. You know, this is not a rural precinct in, you know, Sweden. You know, you're often facing guys armed with pretty lethal firepower. I've heard the same thing about radios, for instance. You know, two-way radios that you have don't function, so you have to use cell phones, which comes with its own set of problems. Torches. You know, going into an informal settlement, chasing someone at night, you end up having to use the torch on your on the same cell phone that you have to use to, you know, try and contact your officers. It's dreadful. It's shocking. I think it also creates a on the stock theft thing. I've actually written about this. Helicopters, quad bikes. Being able to when stock is recovered, it's almost impossible to transport because that also you need like large trailers and things like that. And it's dreadful. Now you're putting all this money into salaries, which is kind of, you know, where what's going to be the first call on your money. But the equipment is necessary to do the kind of policing that that often has to be done. But that also, and it also works against things like bringing technology in. Let's just say that we don't have a CSI style, you know, detective branch.
Right, we know that our forensics labs aren't working.
Yeah, you know, and so what's going to happen? You people who feel they've just had enough of this, who want to make a difference, can just say, "I'll make a difference for myself," and I'll go, you know, God is shaking Qatar or whatever, and or I'll go and work for one of the banks chasing fraudulent transactions, which pay me like, you know, 10 times what I'm making now. Or as we've also seen, some of these guys decamp overseas and, you know, pop up in foreign police forces. But yeah, you know, and I think we are. Given, I think, in South Africa, to pointing a lot of fingers at the state apparatus, and while I think there is plenty to criticise now in our police force, many these guys do a very dangerous job, and there's any number of examples where people have put themselves on the line. And I've said this about the military, so the same thing about the police. Do not expect guys to go and, you know, get shot at, and don't supply them with the equipment they need to do it properly.
Yeah, 100%. And of course, once again, here we see, I think the problem is ultimately, while I'm sure the police definitely could do with more funding overall, the problem is very much connected to the fact that you have this entire sort of political patronage network siphoning all funds, exaggerating costs, inflating the things that should be spent. So, you know, instead of having a contract that fixes six vehicles, you have a contract that only fixes three. And, you know, that means that the money that is being given by the taxpayer to the cops is just not actually reaching the cops. Instead, it's reaching the pockets of various cronies in the system. And until you break down that system.
Yeah. Look, I was told an interesting story a couple of years ago by a police officer working one of the large stations about the contract for feeding guys in the holding cells, and he says that he knows what they pay per meal, and he says, let me say that you may be getting sort of 2 or 3% of that actually appearing in the form of food. So actually, you know, these guys should eat very well, given what they paid. But you know, two slices of brown bread and, you know, like some instant cereal is not what that should buy.
Yes. No, a bad state of affairs, and one that can only be solved by political consequences, I'm afraid. Let's go on to our last story, and this is sort of a neat little bow of how the ANC, I think, has found itself in this position. This is a story from Ground Up. A number of villages near the Kruger National Park have been waiting for many, many years for water infrastructure to be installed. Now, some of these villages had some communal taps, kind of when the new government came in 1994, but they never, there were promises to build more infrastructure. And in 2007, R1 billion was going to be allocated to build new water infrastructure to these villages, and they were going to, get potable water. It's now 2025. 2007 is when the project was launched. No water systems yet. The municipality says, we think we'll be done by 2027. The Auditor General says that, while the municipality blames the poor performance of the engineer on the project, who they have dismissed, the Auditor General says, no, actually, they only applied for the license to get the water from the river in 2014, so it took 7 years to do that, and that there has been a lack of proper planning and coordination. the local people in the village, the poorer people there have to collect water themselves. You have old people who are having to scoop water out of the local river next to cattle. The people in the village who have more money have had to spend upwards of 40,000 rand to build their own pipe systems connecting water from the nearby mountains into their homes directly. And you have old people who sometimes are spending their pension money on buying water. The municipality promises to provide them with water trucks to make sure that they have drinkable water, but these often don't arrive. Terence, as you said in our pre-show discussion, one of the great successes of the ANC post-94 was the number of people they connected to the water grid. But there comes a point, it seems, when the gas in that tank sort of ran out, the petrol ran out in that tank, and those projects have now been languishing in decay, and these people are just kind of being left behind. What do you make of the story?
Yeah, that was Kata Osmal, I remember, in the 1990s. There was a lot of sort of politics around that water is a basic human right, and it was also the first resource that the government nationalized. People often forget that. State custodianship, that was kind of where it started. Okay, so but there were all sorts of it was a very elaborate press campaign. You know, you would have like the millionth person get receiving water in a standpipe, though I think there was some creative accounting with that, because they never released the methodology about how they determined that this was the millionth person. One of the problems is that installed the projects, but wasn't much provision made for maintaining them. And then, just as time went on, it just fell victim to the same incompetence and corruption that seems to have affected everything else. We now end up with, well, cholera. Now, you know, here's what I said earlier. In a city, you need a government. In the rural areas, perhaps you don't. Though I would say, when it comes to providing potable water, you're probably better off with some sort of state apparatus that can do it. It's really just a massive indictment on a systemic failure. And this is like, you know, project one, you know, like exhibit one for the prosecution.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.